Right. Thank you.
Well, this place has changed a lot since I was here 30 years ago. This campus, anyway. It's fun to come back and see it. So here's an overview cartoon. Since you've been talking about this, I don't need to dwell on reionization, but I'll talk a little bit about it. Pointer here. This is a real Luddite talk, no PowerPoint.
That's why we don't give you a laser pointer.
Okay. So we're going to be talking about a somewhat later epoch in reionization of helium, helium plus. And you'll hear me say in conclusion that we think helium is reionized around redshift 3, in contrast to hydrogen, which is redshift of around 6, or maybe a little higher if we really believe WMAP. More on that later. And the other thing I'll say, says it in the bottom, is that whereas quasars probably, whereas stars probably reionized hydrogen, the first galaxies back here at redshift 6 to 10, we think helium too, for Rydberg, is probably dominated by quasars, which peak in abundance at around redshift 3. But I'll explain why we think that later. Now, one of my interests is also population 3, or low metallicity stars. So just to remind you of what is being known now about these early stars, the first stars, if they have no metals, have no CNO burning. So as a consequence, the cores have to collapse and get hotter, and then that affects the whole structure of the star. So they're about twice as hot and five times smaller, and so the zero-age main sequence shifts to the left, to the hotter side. And they're very efficient producers of ionizing radiation, not only hydrogen ionizing, but helium ionizing. So if you can get the first stars to have metallicities below about 10 to the minus 6 solar for a brief era, they can do a lot of damage to ionizing helium at high redshift. So I'll talk about that too. But of course, a real interesting question is how long does it take to pollute and shift over, self-pollute or pollute each other, to shift over the main sequence to the red, back to POP2.
So Mike, can I actually ask, so mm-hmm. My memory is that stars with no metals actually contract to hot enough to make the metals via helium burning and expand back out. So they do CNO burning no matter what. So my question is, yeah. Is POP3, so they're all doing CNO burning, but they make the carbon themselves. So
they make a little bit of carbon. They make about 10 to the minus, up to 10 to the minus 11 or 10 to the minus 10
right.
Carbon.
That's the number. So
yeah, it's very small.
You're 10 to the minus 8.
Yeah, this is safely below. So each one of these things is a decade. They self-pollute in the core. It's questionable whether they blow that out or not. But you're right, they make a little bit from triple alpha.
Yeah.
Okay. Just to drive that point home about how the damage can be done, here's a paper that Jason Tumlinson did with me, and this shows the so-called POP3, the zero metallicity stars, huge amounts of radiation down in the Rydberg continuum compared to a POP2, which has some, but the helium-2 edge is pretty weak. This is only a 15 solar mass star. Stars at 50, 80, 100 put out a huge amount down there. Okay, the other theme I'm going to talk about is observational. And I want to stress the importance of Hubble Space Telescope and also FUSE in this project, in the data of this project. We use quasars as background targets that shine through the intergalactic medium and produce a Lyman alpha forest. The point is that if you go to redshifts bigger than about 2, the helium Lyman alpha forest shifts in, and you can observe it with FUSE and Hubble. Hubble, you need more like 2.8 redshift, but FUSE, you can observe down to about redshift 2 or 2.1, the 304 angstrom line, Lyman alpha. So just to start out with highlights of what I'm going to tell you in the data, here is the first good detection of a bright quasar, 16th magnitude quasar, with both FUSE and Keck. The top is the helium-2 Lyman alpha line, Lyman alpha forest. And the bottom is the H1 Lyman alpha forest observed with Keck. And what we've done is divide the wavelength of hydrogen by 4 so you can align them on the same scale. And what you should immediately see is that the helium-2 opacity is a lot larger than the H1 opacity. And there's a series of papers, all of us in the same group, just permuting, looking and interpreting this data. It was a total of about 600,000 seconds of data, a very hard effort with FUSE. We've since observed a second quasar, and I'll show you new data from that. But those are the only two quasars where you can observe both H1 and helium-2 in the same target. Okay, now I'll be talking about a ratio eta, and so I'll show this highlight picture here and hit one of the punchlines. Eta is defined as the ratio of the column density of helium-2 over the column density of H1. So it's a dimensionless ratio. And naively, you might say, well, helium is 8% the abundance of hydrogen, so eta should be 0.08. But in fact, we find eta is typically 50 or 100. And moreover, not only is it high, but it fluctuates all over the place. We call this fine-grained variation. So this ratio varies from values down. I think some of these values down near 1 are possibly spurious. But certainly values of several up to several hundred over delta z of 10 to the minus 3, which is about 1 to 2 megaparsecs physical at redshift 2.5. So this is really one of the highlights, unexpected results, that the radiation field that produces this ratio from photoionization must fluctuate on a fine-grained scale. We were so surprised that we did a lot of experiments with the detector and the noise characteristics. We played with the bin size, and we couldn't get it to go away. And it's also been seen reproduced in the second sight line. So we think it's real, and we think it tells us something pretty interesting about the sources of the background, ionizing background, and also the radiative transfer. Physical, yeah. At redshift 2.5, it's 1.3 megaparsecs for H70 physical. The other thing I want to tell you that FUSE and Hubble have done goes right to this issue of what are the sources? What are the quasars doing down in the ionizing background? This is Hubble's STIS. Of course, it's dead now. But we've got a lot of archival data on quasar spectra. And this is FUSE picking up where Hubble leaves off. We actually have about 50 angstroms overlap between, so we can patch them together. So we can fit the continuum and the emission lines and see what's happening to the continuum as it goes into the ultraviolet. At low redshift, moderate redshift of a few tenths, you shift the Lyman continuum up into the FUSE band and even the Hubble band. So we can actually see the rest frame extreme ultraviolet and measure it. So I'll be telling you about that.
What was Lyman beta?
It's Lyman beta 06. This is actually mostly oxygen 6. That's Lyman alpha, carbon 4, silicon 4, O4. Yeah. There's actually a few other lines in here. In fact, let me show you this next spectrum where I've got them labeled. We found some very interesting things about quasars themselves, not just the IGM. So here's a paper that Jennifer Scott led the effort on, but all the same group. This is a composite spectrum of 73 quasars. So here's that line you asked about, Piero. It's mostly 06. Down here in the rest frame, ultraviolet, or EUV, 760 angstroms is neon 8, a very clear feature. Oxygen 3, 833. Lyman gamma, higher Lyman lines, et cetera. So the composite spectrum has, if you like, F sub nu, which most of us do, nu to the minus 0.56. And that's quite a bit harder than the old Telfer et al. Number of nu to the minus 1.8 from Hubble. We think this is a luminosity effect. Quasars' spectra change as they get brighter. The Hubble ones are farther away. And so there's a Malmquist bias and a luminosity bias. These are brighter targets than those. Nevertheless, this is one source of variation. If you assume nu to the minus 1.8, like many of us have in the past, that's characteristic of the Hubble sample. The more local sample seems to be harder. to the minus 1.6. And finally, somebody asked me at coffee about the future of UV astronomy. And I said I had one slide. This is the future. This is the Cosmic Origin Spectrograph, COS, which Colorado built with Ball Aerospace. And it sits back in a clean room at NASA headquarters. Not headquarters. NASA Goddard. That's a good joke. I should use that again. NASA Goddard. Yeah. So I always tell, people, you remember that Indiana Jones movie at the very end where they cart the Holy Grail off, box it up? So that's where it is, in a clean room. But there's some hope that robots can reinstall it on Hubble in 2007. This spectrograph is 20 times more throughput than STIS at pretty high resolution. So this is the future of UV astronomy, or something like it. If we don't launch it, we'll hopefully build something else, put it on a 2-meter mid-X. But right now, with STIS dead and only FUSE up there, there's not a whole lot going on. Okay, on to reionization, just to remind people of...
On your previous slide, where you compared the spectra of computers and HST, it's possible that you have the redshift there, just a bias to...
Redshift evolution? Yeah, we considered that. We have enough spread in redshift, overlap in redshift of both samples, that it doesn't look like it's that. Could be a little of that. As you will see later in the talk, these composites each have huge ranges. So this is just the average of something that varies all over the place.
Can you try normalizing for a population which might have been similar in terms of looking at the perhaps the weaker HST images and see where the spectrum is a function of brightness?
We looked at luminosity. We took bolometric luminosity and found something like an L to the 1/2 dependence in slope. And that's discussed in the paper in more detail. So we think it's mostly a luminosity effect. It's called the Baldwin effect, if you know about quasars, which you probably do. No. The Baldwin effect says that emission lines and continuum ratios are a function of luminosity. So something about the accretion disk changes as they go up into a bright state, and they get harder. So we think that's what's going on.
Can the scatter that you see in the composite spectrum alone explain the fluctuations you see in eta?
Stay tuned. Most of it. Quick answer is most of it. But not all of it. Okay. So again, in the way of reviewing what is known from the high redshift Lyman alpha forest of hydrogen, it's looking like the transmission or the flux, line blanketed transmitted flux, is going away. And if you use simulations, as Nick and Nadine has done, it goes away consistent with about redshift 6.2, somewhere around there. Now, it's subtle effect, depending on whether you mass weight the neutral fraction or volume weight it. But the neutral fraction mass weighted is several 10 to the minus 3, volume weighted below 10 to the minus 4 out here at these redshifts. And then it very quickly climbs and becomes ionized. So it doesn't take much neutral fraction to produce the Lyman alpha forest. So people have wondered whether, okay, is it really going away completely, or does it drop to 10 to the minus 3 and then level out? And that's really what the controversy is all about. We just don't know yet. And the WMAP controversy makes this even more interesting. The other bit of background that I want to review is theoretical work that we've done on the mean free path, co-moving mean free path, of a line blanketed Lyman alpha line at the top. So you can see that the transition from redshifts 7 or 8 through 6 into 5 is pretty sharp. So it does make sense to bisect this line and say, well, somewhere around redshift 6.2, 6.3, it's suddenly changing. The mean free path really, really gets long at lower redshift. This is simulation from Ganaden at the top. Okay. Now, again, the controversy is we don't really know what the sources are back here. So there's some controversy about whether it plateaus here or a little higher, what the tail is. And the WMAP results would suggest possible reionization or partial reionization at higher redshifts could still be consistent with this. Now, the bottom is theoretical work that Mark Fardal did with me and Mark Giroux. And this is relevant to the helium. If you do radiative transfer in a clumpy IgM, an interesting thing to compute is the tau continuum dz. So you do a model for the cloudy IgM, and you shoot rays through it, and you ask, at what rate does the optical depth build up? And if you take the reciprocal of this, you get the redshift of a tau equal 1 sphere. How far do you have to go out in redshift before a photon is absorbed in the continuum? OK, so you can see immediately that this is a swath of models parameterizing the uncertainty in the IgM. This is hydrogen. This is helium. It's about a factor of 10 different. Helium is much more opaque. So I scribbled in some numbers. For d tau dz of 10 at redshift 2.5, 10 or 20, the reciprocal of that is a tenth. So you have to go out 0.1 in redshift before you're absorbed. That's about 34 co-moving, no, co, not co-moving, 34 physical megaparsecs. Whereas in hydrogen, it's almost 200 megaparsecs you go.
So the delta z that defines the mean free path is actually much larger than the delta z over which you're seeing the
That's right. And that you're jumping ahead in the talk a bit. That is the problem. That is the quandary. If you just looked at this before we had the data, you would have said, well, this is a large sphere, 180 megaparsecs, lots of sources inside that, probably. So the fluctuations in hydrogen opacity wouldn't be large. 34 megaparsecs, that's getting smaller, but there's still quite a few sources in there. The fluctuations should be still pretty small. I think what we're going to conclude is that this is not the right thing to look at. It's not spherical radiative transfer. It's a clumpy IgM. There's little pathways that photons go a long, long distance. And so the contrast is going to be even bigger than this. OK, so those are the highlights. Now let me go back and pick up some of the details on why we said what we did. OK, so this is our discovery paper, Chris et al. Back in 2001. And there's been several papers since then. This is a quasar of its 16th magnitude at redshift 2.9. And what we found was when you measure the optical depth of the Lyman forest, helium Lyman alpha forest, a very smooth gradual rise back to about redshift 2.7, and then suddenly it started getting very patchy. You have regions where the optical depth is 2, 3, even 4 in certain broadband regions. But in between, there was a couple, actually three, places where the optical depth is low, high transmission. So it's very patchy. Now, the hydrogen IgM is sort of the same. There's a lot of cosmic variance. Sightline to sightline varies a lot. This is the only sightline that we had back then. We have a second one now that shows a similar trend back to about redshift 2.9, then it jumps a bit. OK, so allowing for a little bit of overlap and a little bit of cosmic variance, we think that the epoch where it starts to get patchy is 2.8 redshift. You could push it back a little bit to 3 if you want. But at this point, the ionization fronts are starting to overlap, percolate. And this is the equivalent of the redshift 6 epoch for hydrogen.
Is it a third point there in the corner?
That's a low transmission window right up near the quasar, maybe proximity. The quasar is right here. So that's why I didn't circle it. I think that might be proximity. Don't know.
Are the dotted lines supposed to be an estimate of how much scatter you get from density fluctuations, or?
Yeah, this was our theoretical paper with Mark Fardal's thesis, where we took a cloudy IgM, and these are 1-sigma excursions, basically cosmic variance, from what we would have predicted for the mean.
Does that model include fluctuations in the UV background or density
no.
fluctuations alone?
Only density alone. Okay. Yeah, consistent with the DNDZ of Lyman alpha clouds. It's a pretty detailed model, but back then we didn't know about the wide variations in sources, and we didn't put that in. So that would introduce more, but I'm not sure that much more. OK, the more recent analyses of the same object were published this year, early this year. It's all the same group, two different cuts at the data analysis and the background subtraction, but but all the same raw data. This is a paper that, the second paper, Zheng et al. Led, in which, again, the mean eta, helium-2 to H1 ratio, is about 50. But you had excursions down to 1 and upper limits up above 1,000. Now, in our first paper, one that I led, we had numbers between eta of several and maybe 200. We were more conservative about the backgrounds, more conservative about what we believed a line to be than Wei Zheng was. Some of these features up here are probably noise and or metal lines. If a metal line masquerades as helium, that pushes you up. So I think some of these probably are metal lines. Likewise, these numbers below 2 or so, I think, are mostly noise. And we have a long discussion in our first paper about the noise effects. Nevertheless, I would say this middle range, this factor of more than 10, maybe even 50, range in eta seems to be real. So what does it? Well, one clue that we started looking at subsets of the data was the following. So we took eta and we asked what quasar source spectrum would be consistent with the helium-2 to H1 ratio. That quasar source spectrum is nu to the minus alpha, S. We took that, filtered it through the radiative transfer code, and this is the answer to your question, Adam. When we bend the data into what we call void absorbers and filament absorbers in green, we found that they were really quite different. A filament is basically an optical depth greater than 0.05, pretty strong H or Lyman alpha hydrogen absorber. And those had eta's peaking down around 10, or sorry, source spectra peaking around 1. Whereas the void absorbers had source spectra peaking around alpha of 3, very soft radiation fields. Okay, so how did we interpret this? There's a lot of ways to interpret it. One idea was, well, maybe the voids are full of soft starburst galaxies. They don't have quasars with hard spectra, they have softer spectra.
Can you define the void here?
These voids and filaments are all defined in terms of the Lyman alpha optical depth of hydrogen. So if the optical depth is bigger than 0.05 or 1.1, a strong absorber, we call that a filament. And if it's very weak, we call it a void. And that's consistent with simulations. OK, so it could be soft ionizing sources in the voids, lots of low mass galaxies, stars. And likewise, it could be that the quasars, the harder sources, are confined to the filaments. OK, so to test that, that's what this black dotted line, alpha EUV, is. We looked at the range of quasar spectra measured by Hubble. So this is back in 2002. So you can explain quite a bit of the range. There's a range from 0 up to about 3, but not all of it. So our conclusion was that it's probably a radiative transfer effect, RT effect, plus AGN. But this bottom line, it has to be a clumpy IgM in order to get the fluctuations. We think that the radiative transfer has to be done leaking through the long pathways and tunnels rather than just a spherical or radial transport.
Mike, every helium cloud is seeing a few quasars anyway. So aren't you washing out the variation of the spectrum of the sources?
Yeah.
Just simply due to the fact that you know, your optical attenuation sphere contains
right.
a few quasars, maybe very many faint quasars.
Right. Going into this, we wouldn't have predicted this eta variation. We would have said the sphere, eta sphere, or tautical 1 sphere is 30 megaparsecs. And so there would have been. Well, not that many. If you have 10 to the minus 6 per cubic megaparsec, the co-moving density, then that's 100 megaparsecs co-moving, and then divide by 3.5, 1 plus z. So now you're down at around 25. So there's not many within a 30 megaparsec.
But the distribution of alpha spectra, and so you should see some mean flux anyway. That's
what we would have thought. We would have thought, actually we more than thought, we calculated it. and we found only a few percent fluctuations in the 1 Rydberg continuum and maybe 20% in the 4 Rydberg. So we were surprised for reasons just like you said. Okay, so what does the radiation look like? This is just a schematic of what the IGM will do to a bare quasar. So the quasar is a power law, nu to the minus alpha. And then when it goes through an IGM, as several groups have found, Hart and Madow were the first to show this, but then Fardal, Drew, and I did a similar code. You put an edge or a notch at 1 Rydberg and a big edge or notch at 4 Rydbergs, and then you smooth it out because of redshifting, universe's redshifting. The other thing you do is reprocess and put in a Lyman alpha line, 304 angstrom, and it's attenuated, not attenuated, but blurred to lower energy because of redshifting. And that's basically it. There's 2-photon emission and other things that happen. What matters for the eta ratio is the ratio of flux at 4 Rydbergs, which we call J helium 2, to the flux at 1 Rydberg, J H1. And the bigger that jump, bigger that ratio, the higher the eta. If you have a very steep spectrum, that's good for helium 2, because there's not much radiation up here at 4 Rydbergs to ionize the helium 2. Whereas if it's a hard spectrum, that's bad for helium 2. That kills helium 2. That makes a low eta, because now you've got a lot of 4 Rydberg flux. So that's basically the radiative transfer. Let me skip over this. I might as well show this. This is our new work that just came out in November in the APJ that Jennifer Scott looked at. This is the spectrum of the distribution of quasar EUV spectral indices, nu to the minus alpha. The crosshatched is the fuse, which is the lower redshift sample, redshifts less than about 0.3. And then the other one is from Telfer et al. Paper back in 2002 from Hubble. A little bit higher redshift, more luminous quasars. So you can see this effect, that the spectral index for the fuse sample, nu to the minus 0.56, whereas the Hubble sample is a little bit softer. But they both have a lot of spread. So I'd like to show you now is some later work, subsequent work that we've done, really looking into more detail on the quasars on which this distribution is based. So Drew Clausen is an undergrad who did a senior thesis with me, and I succeeded in convincing him that he should go into string theory. So he's applying for grad schools now in particle physics, but he did a thesis in astrophysics. Smart man. What we did was look at, I didn't convince you.
Well, you did take string theory and turn them into
astronomy. I know. That's why I said that here. So what did we do? We looked at a little more detail at this. We took all the quasars, shifted them to the rest frame, normalized their fluxes to 1 at the 912 angstrom Lyman limit. And so what you see here going off into the EUV is what a wide range there is in data. Now, everything that's dotted is extrapolated, where we don't have flux. Everything that's a solid line, we actually have fuse data. So you can see it's based on a very small number of quasars that actually go down into the rest frame EUV. And if any of you are interested in the names and numbers of them, there they are. So I hope you take away from this that this problem is really unsolved. We don't really know the EUV fluxes for very many quasars. Here's 912. And it's dominated, you can see, if you just weighted it by flux, 3C273 would dominate. That's why we pinned them all in this bow tie. Okay, so I consider this still an open problem. To go back to the fundamental question, which is eta variations, there's a wide range of these indices, but each one of these indices is not very well determined because it's mostly based on extrapolation. And so a lot more work has to be done. I think COS, if we can get it up there, we'll be able to go for many, many more quasars, really nail this problem. Okay. Now I'm going to show you a little more detail on this Lyman Alpha forest. Several of you have asked some detailed questions at lunch and coffee. This is the famous quasar, the first one that we looked at. It was discovered by Dieter Reimers in the Hamburg survey. It's a wonderful source. It's redshift 2.89, 16th magnitude, and more than that, we were really lucky. The Lyman Alpha forest has a Lyman limit system right here at redshift 2.75, and yet it still recovers in time by the time we get down to the fuse band to have enough flux that we can observe it. So we were very fortunate to be able to observe it both with Hubble and with fuse. This is the VLT spectra that allowed us to get the hydrogen Lyman Alpha forest. Okay, so a couple of more detailed things that have come out of this more detailed analysis. The first, I've already shown this, but I want to show it in a slightly different way. This patchy high optical depth region that if you look in a very fine grained scale, optical depths exceed 4, maybe even 5 up here at redshift 2.8. Everything else looks like what we would have predicted. 1 plus z to the 3.5 is a pretty good fit to the theoretical predictions. The eta ratio, you might ask, well, did it change with redshift? Because the radiation field was changing, say. Well, we didn't see any real sign of changing by a lot, but if you fit these big error bar fluctuations, it's pretty constant at about 50. You know, you could say, well, it's tilted a little, but not statistically significantly. Now, the predicted changes in the radiation field actually occur a little bit higher. There's been some suggestions that at redshifts 3 or 3.4, that's when a lot of the change occurred. We don't have any quasars up there bright enough to look at, so I can't comment on that. But one goal of COSS, one really good observation, would be to look at the one quasar at redshift 3.3 and see if this ratio suddenly changes due to reionization. How do we assign them? The horizontal error bars are just the band. Okay. The vertical error bars are root n fluctuations in that band of all that range of eta. So remember, eta varies a lot. It's not really an error bar, it's the width of the distribution.
Are those supposed to be independent measures?
Each one of these? Yeah. So we take a band in redshift, and we just take all the fluctuations, take their mean, and their 1 sigma distribution width. And that's what's plotted here. I shouldn't say error bar. That's a misnomer.
Chi-square or something like that, it's going to be sort of like a problem for independent measures.
You're saying they're not big enough, fluctuations?
Error bars are too large.
Yeah, well, I misspoke. They're not error bars. It's the width of the distribution. This fine-grained fluctuation is what you're seeing. Yeah, it's not an error bar. The other thing that's really interesting, if you want to try to get a temperature out of these things, and this experiment's been done for the hydrogen Lyman Alpha forest, is you look at the line width or the Doppler parameter, which is called B, when you fit a Gaussian to it. And if they were thermally broadened, because helium is 4 times heavier, the helium B value should be half of the hydrogen value, square root of 2kT over m. So this dotted line is what you'd expect for thermal broadening. If they were equal, namely that it's microturbulence, they would be along this line. Our best fit ratio is 0.95. So it looks more like turbulent, macroscopic turbulent motions are broadening them, not thermal motions. That's going to make it tough to measure line widths and use them as a thermometer. There's some hope that you could use maybe the lower envelope and derive a temperature, but not from this data. Okay, now I mentioned we had a second sight line. And here it is. We lucked out. This quasar HS1700, which is fairly bright, flared by a factor of 2 in the UV. And so we have a paper that Dieter Reimers is heading up, in which we plotted the same log eta, helium 2 to H1 ratio. versus column density of H1. And you should treat this the same way I said voids and filaments. Treat this as a proxy for overdensity or whether it's a void or filament. If you look at this, you can see that above about log n of 12 and a half, there's a definite downward trend. And then maybe it's flat below that. Okay. The mean for the sample is log eta of 1.7, so eta of 50, same as before. And this downward trend is consistent with our earlier finding that the ratio is high in voids and low in filaments. I said that there. Weak absorbers have high eta. Strong absorbers have low eta. So that's sort of the lasting conclusion that we've come to, that somehow quasar distributions, source distributions, plus radiative transfer changes the radiation field to make it harder up here at high column and softer at low column. And if you want to see the actual data that was based on, here's our scatter plot. Some of them have very large error bars, but still, I think you can see there's at least a decade or more of variation in this eta ratio. And it changes on a pretty fine-grained scale. These tick marks are 0.01. So this isn't quite as good data as my earlier source, but it shows the same general trend. Okay, I wanted to end up by trying to pull this together with what we think we know from the CMB. So again, I don't need to remind people here of this too much, just to show you that from a cross-correlation of temperature fluctuations and polarization correlations, the so-called C sub L of TE, the WMAP folks have inferred an optical depth of around 0.17, plus or minus a lot, to reionization. Now, they themselves will be the first to tell you that this is not a great fit. There's a L equals 7 point that's way off, and an L equals 3 point, and even L equals 5. It's not a great fit. A lot of this may have to do with foreground subtraction, things on a very large angular scale, like the North Polar Spur, Gum Nebula, supernova remnants. But they've done the best they can. And this swath is consistent with their optical depth, 0.17. This shows the chi-square likelihood function at the bottom. So here's 0.17, which is the center of the distribution. But you can see that it's extremely broad. And so when they marginalize against other things and beat down the error bar to 0.04, I think it's worth keeping in mind that really anything from 0.07 up to about 0.25 would be consistent with this. And in fact, when you include the power spectrum of the Sloan survey galaxies, Max Tegmark et al. Had a paper in which the tau was 0.12 plus 0.09 minus 0.06. So an awful lot's been made of this. In my opinion, maybe too much. We ought to just stay tuned and see what second and third year WMAP data bring us. I'm being what?
You're about to receive transmitter. The other transmitter.
Oh. Oh, that's stay tuned. I see. You're taking me very literally. I could tell you more because I've talked to some of the CMB folks on why. And the quick version is, maybe you know this, that they're struggling with the covariance and cross correlations of all the parameters. And until they understand them, they're not publishing. They know the theorists too well. They don't want to see another 100 papers. Okay, what does this have to do with what I've been telling you about reionization at redshift 6 in hydrogen? Let me be coy and cover up the bottom. Okay, so if you just take a naive model, don't do anything fancy, just integrate the optical depth with your standard Friedmann omega lambda line element. You can do this integral analytically, and here it is. Just depends on 1 plus z to the 3 halves, basically. As you go to higher and higher redshift, the omega lambda doesn't matter compared to omega m, and you get this. The optical depth is about 0.002, 1 plus z to the 3 halves, where z sub r is where it suddenly drops. It's fully ionized back to z sub r, then it drops to a small value. So put the favorite values of WMAP in, you know, mega M plus omega lambda equal 1 universe. Correct for helium, I added in, since this is a talk on helium, the little correction for the helium ionization. It doesn't make a big difference. I took the Tegmark value of 0.12 from WMAP plus Sloan. You would have predicted 1 plus Z for reionization of 14 to get that kind of optical depth. So something's very inconsistent. If we wanted to get this down to 7, 1 plus Z of 7, you've got to change this by a lot. So personally, I think theorists should have the courage of their convictions. I'm going to predict that the second year data is going to come down a lot, because I don't think you can get quite that much optical depth.
But to be fair, if you took the estimator from Tegmark et al.,
yes,
0.2 plus 0.09 minus 0.06.
Yes.
Right, and study.
Or actually, plus 0.09
right,
minus 0.06.
Right.
Yeah.
And you took that and asked, what is the equivalent error on C sub R?
Propagate the errors.
It would be large.
You're right.
In fact, it would be almost factor 2.
Well, you've stolen my punchline, which is I think that you can make them all consistent just by looking at that broad error. But what I'd like to say really is let's wait and see if the error bars do, if this comes down and the error bars sharpen up. But yeah, I agree completely. Just to show you though what some theorists have done, and we're certainly not unique, there's been 30 or 40 papers written. Aparna Venkatesan, who I gather was here, I think she was here a couple weeks ago. Before the WMAP, we did a reionization model where we added in pre-reionization X-ray sources, mini black holes, and so on, just to see how much we could bump the standard prediction. If you take a standard IMF and run a reionization model, which climbs steadily and then plateaus off, you could bump it by about 0.01 in optical depth from X-rays. If you put in these high-mass population 3, low-metallicity stars, up to maybe 100 solar masses, you could get that up to 0.10. That would push the epoch back farther. One thing I just did for the fun of it a couple months ago, I looked at the best calculations of freeze-out in a Big Bang. I used to remember that the freeze-out number was 10 to the minus 5, but then I remembered, oh, that was for omega equal 1. The early calculations assumed the universe was all baryons, and that's, of course, not right. That's only 4.5% baryons. So Sarah Seeger and her collaborators redid that calculation. It freezes out at a much higher number, 10 to the minus 3.3. So if you do that integral, you get also 0.012 back to redshift 500. You can push it back a little bit farther, but then the transfer scattering gets a little bit tricky. But the point is, you could probably boost it by a few hundredths just from residual freeze-out.
But the model that you're showing up there is assuming the realization was at 6 or 7, right?
This model here is consistent with, what is that? Yeah, about 6 or 7. That's right. If you did this, I didn't plot that, but if you did the 0.1, as you know, because you've done similar things, that pushes this back a little higher. So just shift the curve a little bit more. Okay, so I think if you add higher mass, low metallicity stars, add a little bit of contribution for the freeze out, you can probably get it up to 0.1, optical depth 0.1. And that would be consistent with a lot of models. I'll just show. I was going to show your thing.
Thank you.
Shall I take it down?
Yeah, because actually I have to disagree with what you just said.
Let's go back. That's all right. I was going to show another year of plots. Maybe I'll stop.
No, I mean, just one comment.
Yes.
This is considering the effect of X-ray ionization, purely X-ray ionization.
This is partial ionization from X-rays. Right.
As you know, it can get to 10%. And after it saturates, because the secondary electrons start to be inefficient in
right.
So, but if you have a very big X-ray background and high redshift, then these X-ray photons are redshifted in the UV.
Where they do more damage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They can actually increase the ionization fraction above 10%, and you can get.
By fraction, do you mean tau, or do you mean?
the partial units.
Ionization fraction. Ionization, okay. Yeah.
About 10%, and then the tau that you can get is larger than probably what you were mentioning.
Well, this one, we didn't take that into account. I know you did a paper with Ostreicher where you...
Yeah, I mean, it's an extreme model. I agree with you.
Uh-huh.
It can be completely wrong, and it's just introduced because tau is so large, and we don't really do experiment tau. But it's not ruled out.
Okay. Well, this is a pretty conservative model where we took the extrapolation of the X-ray background that we measure, extrapolated out consistent with Sloan quasars.
Yeah, I have much more. I have
you added more.
Of X-ray emitting source at 17. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. Well, I was just going to show, since Massimo was here, a cartoon of the picture where you use a simulation to see what goes on at redshifts 21, 17, 15, 13. The ionization fronts, these are in hydrogen that you've rendered. And so the picture is that these things overlap eventually down by redshift 6 or 7, but there's still a lot of electrons that can scatter the background in that. Okay, the last view graph, just to summarize some of our recent thoughts, or not so recent thoughts, is that it's possible, if you really must explain this high redshift ionization by early stars or early X-ray sources, it's possible that there were two epochs. And Aparna and Jason Tumlinson and I did some work back in 2003 suggesting that the hot stars, which can ionize helium-2 very well, could have produced not full ionization, but maybe 30% ionization back at high redshifts. But then it very quickly plummeted, especially if there's a large clumping factor that dominates recombination. So it reionized, it dropped, and then it came back up. And this second track is by quasars. And since there's one other handle we have on that picture, namely metallicity, most of our recent work has been on how many metals come with this population of stars. If they're early stars with the theoretical yield that we think high mass stars have, you would build up to about 10 to the minus 4 solar metallicity at a peak star formation rate of 0.1 solar masses per year per cubic megaparsec after 10 to the 8th years. And that's still well below the floor that we see at high redshift. So there's nothing that I know of that can rule this out yet. We'd love to go see these things. Unfortunately, they probably come in small clumps. The star formation is in small clumps. And those are going to be very hard to see, even with JWST. So I think there's still a very strong case for a 30-meter, not just a 10-meter UV in space, but a 30-meter on the ground. Okay, thank you.
Just leave it there. I have a question.
Yep.
So 10 to the minus 4 would be redshift 10 or so, right?
This peak is reached at about redshift 10, that's right.
So then they continue, so
you should. Well, actually, this is the value reached at 10 before redshift 10 from Z of 20 to 10 using Massimo's simulations. It increases exponentially. 10 to the minus 3 up to 10 to the minus 1. So at redshift 10, it wouldn't be quite that yet. But shortly after that, redshift maybe 8 or 7, it would be reaching that. In other words, it comes up and then it stays flat from redshift 9 or 10 down to about redshift 2.
Even though the F is continuing to increase below redshift 10.
F of?
Yes, that line.
Yes?
It's still increasing. Right?
It's still increasing, right.
Five or so.
We didn't turn the stars off.
Right. So
we just had them.
The magnitude should be much higher at redshift 5 than that value.
That's right. Well, not the. This value is just a characteristic value. If you had it at a constant rate, this is not meant to be the exact calculation. This is just meant to give you a scaling factor. To get the exact factor, you should have it integrated up and follow the history. And there's many possible histories. And many people have done those. I'm not going to repeat that here. This is the Hubble time at redshift 20. So this is, again, a characteristic scaling factor. At redshift 20, this star formation rate co-moving would be about 10 to the minus 3 in those units.
Yeah,
what I was thinking is just already at redshift 20, you have that metallicity of 10 to the minus 4.
No, at redshift 20, I would say drop this down by 100, 10 to the minus 6.
Okay.
Yeah, at 20. At 10, characteristic at 10 would be that, or 8 or something like that. You've got to wait one Hubble time. This is not meant to be a calculation rigorous. It's just the order of magnitude estimate. Not even accurate to a factor of 3, probably.
So let's go back to the fine grain structure.
Yes.
Okay.
Please.
Explanation for that. You're sort of left it.
Well,
maybe,
maybe this. Yeah. Well, that's work in progress. You know the result. That's work in progress. My intermediate summary is that a lot of that variation is fluctuations in the intrinsic quasar spectrum, but that's not it alone,
yes.
Because you've got to get it fluctuating on 1 megaparsec,
that's right.
And the quasars are many megaparsecs apart.
So what, there must be a characteristic scale that enters in the other transparent. I can see mean distance between sources,
yeah. Right.
Or mean free path.
And it's mostly the mean free path. A spherical transfer mean free path is 30 megaparsecs. That can't be right. It's got to be, there can't be spheres that tau equal 1. They must be long salamanders, long pathways where light can go a long distance, and then small path lengths where it fluctuates a lot.
The mean free path would be just from simulation, right? There is nothing on simulation that gives you
megaparsec.
Fine structure on 1 megaparsec.
Right. But I would argue that the simulations don't resolve that yet. And I'm working with Nick Naden, who has a new code with adaptive mesh, and we're going to explore that. But I don't have anything to report yet. I think that's probably going to be what we need to make this.
1 megaparsec proper.
No, physical.
Yeah.
But proper,
so
yeah.
Physical.
Yeah, physical, proper. Not co-moving.
Simulation to resolve.
It's related. I think it's related to transfer. Mike. I'll show you the result before, right? So.
Didn't I just say that it was radiative transfer?
Yeah,
I agree with you.
But radiative transfer, it's a word. You know, there must be a physical explanation why. There must be a lane that enters.
Filaments.
There's got to be fluctuations in the gas density down to megaparsec scale.
If it's the size of a filament, I'm just saying that first of all, you make a simulation, do we solve 1 megaparsec
yeah.
problem or zero? Right. There is no problem with that.
Right.
I guess you're right. Some of the good simulations get down to 100 kiloparsecs, co-moving.
I don't think the problem is the simulation.
We've got some experts here.
And it's not in the distance between filaments.
Yeah.
It could be the thickness of a filament, right?
Well, it's not the thickness physical. It's the column density that matters. You have to have fluctuations in column density on the order of 10 to the 18th column density. Oh, I neglected to say one thing. I also think that at 4 Rydbergs, the quasars themselves may have edges inside the broadline region. So a photon working its way out of a quasar may have a tough time. And in this one quasar that we've looked at, there's no proximity effect. We think there's a 10 to the 18th column absorber there that's killing the photons.
So you see the Lyman limit in helium. You see the Lyman edge in helium.
Right. We don't see a proximity effect shelf. It's sharp. And we think that's because there's an absorber down, a warm absorber or something down in the quasar nucleus. So a lot of quasars may have that. I think the 4 Rydberg radiation field is fluctuating a lot. But that still doesn't solve the problem for the reasons we've discussed. The 1 megaparsec scale has to be something else. Because the quasars aren't a megaparsec apart. They're much farther apart. This is probably the only audience that would stay with me on all this technical stuff. So thank you. You've been very generous. Phil?
What assumptions were you making in the final point?
Yeah. Well, it's based on studies we did. We proposed for NIRCam also, lost out to Arizona. But we did some studies of what you could see, say, at 3 microns or 4 microns, from a high redshift galaxy at redshift 8, 7 or 8, and high redshift supernova and all that. If the galaxies are small, 10 to the 8th, 10 to the 9th solar mass objects, rather than L-star galaxies, it'll be very tough to see them. or if the star formation rate that you predict for them is too small. If they go through a burst, and I'm hoping they will, they can see them. But a standard galaxy with a standard star formation rate is just too faint, yeah, unfortunately. And they shrunk it on us, too. JWST used to be 8 meters, now it's 6. That didn't help. So there's a future.
So I can't even remember that there is a, I might be wrong, there is a paper by SMET in which they try to model these fluctuations in the alien opacity with the spheres. Do their results agree with yours or not?
That's the same target, actually.
Yes,
I know. Yeah. And so those little patchy windows that I showed at redshift 2.8, that's what they were modeling.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And yes, it agrees. The transmissions agree within 5% of ours on the data. Their work was with Hubble, and ours was with FUSE. That's the only difference.
And their interpretation is that it's a local ionizing radiation.
Local ionizing sources, quasars perhaps. Yeah. Now there's been a lot of work now with big telescopes trying to see those sources, and you know, going, you have to go off the path length. You're gonna be a big field.
Yeah. And what do they see?
I'm not doing those myself, so I haven't heard. I think they are seeing sources. This one HS1700 that I showed second, that's part of a study that Chuck Steidel and Rob Simcoe are doing. I am collaborating with them, connecting metal line systems with helium too. And they're going to also find the galaxies. But I don't know what they found yet.
See, before we break up, I just wanted to, Mark Krumholz is visiting from Berkeley. He'll be giving a talk tomorrow at noon over in Broida, and I'll send an announcement on massive star formation, I think is the title.
Making high mass stars for fun and profit.
Okay, right. So that'll be at noon, so everybody knows.
Okay, great. And I'll be around tomorrow all day, too, so if anyone wants to talk further, come see me.
Thank you.
Okay.